He's the perfect combination of man and machine, armed with the firepower of a high-tech army. Jagged Steel, fourth in the electrifying Steel series by JD Masters. For Ed Bryant, with friendship and affection. Chapter 1. Oliver Higgins, his elegantly tailored suit freshly pressed and his graying hair carefully combed, took his seat behind the table and pulled the mic over in front of him. He straightened his silk-fullered tie, glanced up nervously at the members of the subcommittee, and moistened his lips. He poured himself a glass of water from the carafe on the table, took a sip, and waited for the hammer to fall. "Thank you for coming, Mr. Higgins." Senator Carman, the chairman, sat in the center of the raised dais, flanked by the other members of the subcommittee. Having greeted him, he then looked down and started leafing through the report before him, ignoring him completely. He was in his early 60s, heavyset, with a thick shock of snow-white hair and bright blue eyes. He looked like an amiable Irish uncle, and he spoke softly, with a touch of gravel in his voice. But Higgins knew that his polite and charming manner was deceiving. Carman could make or break him. The senator from Massachusetts was one of the most influential legislators in Congress, chairman of both the Armed Forces and the Ways and Means Committees. He was one of the people who controlled the purse strings, and he made no secret of his dislike for the CIA. Carman felt that the agency had outlived its usefulness. In the days before the bio war, there had been a pressing need for gathering intelligence concerning the operations of foreign governments. But now most of these governments had either collapsed or were hanging on by a thread, including the crippled government of what was left of the United States. The genetically engineered plague that had been released upon the world by Islamic terrorists and the brief aborted nuclear exchange that followed it had wiped out most of 3/4 of the world's population. Most surviving governments were too busy trying to control the anarchy within their own borders to concern themselves with what was happening in other countries. It would be a long time before any government grew strong enough to pose a threat to other nations. There was a limited amount of contact, a foreign policy predicated on mutual survival and reorganization. But by and large, isolationism was the order of the day. With Washington, D.C. reduced to a puddle of radioactive glass, the federal government had moved to New York City. What had once been the UN Secretariat building, the tall glass slab that rose up over the East River, now housed the administrative offices of Congress and various governmental agencies, the CIA among them. The president resided on the 37th floor, the General Assembly building, the smaller, cell-shaped structure adjoining the Secretariat, now housed the Congress of the United States, and Higgins sat in one of its quiet, plenary meeting rooms. Not all 50 states were represented in Congress. There were no representatives from Alaska, Hawaii, Texas, or Nevada. Perhaps survivors still existed in Alaska and Hawaii, but there was no functioning authority in either state. As for Nevada, most of it was still too hot for anyone to enter safely. And following the war, Texas had seceded from the Union to form its own republic. All efforts to bring it back into the fold had thus far met with failure. After the plague had been released, the superpowers had ordered retaliatory strikes, each thinking that the other was responsible. However, only a small portion of the world's nuclear arsenal was actually launched. Missile control personnel had keeled over at their consoles and died with their fingers poised over the buttons, leaving the missile silos still standing in launch mode in their silos. Strikes had occurred, but not all designated targets had been hit. Moscow and London were both gone. Paris had been partially reduced to rubble. Peking was nuked into oblivion. Isolated strikes had occurred throughout Europe, Asia, and the United States, South America, the African continent, Australia, Greenland, Canada, and Mexico, most of Southeast Asia, the Scandinavian countries, and Japan had escaped the fire, but they had not escaped unscathed. The rapidly spreading airborne plague had done its work, decimating the defenseless populations as the virus went through its series of mutations before it finally reached the end of its cycle. The government of the United States, what remained of it, was headquartered in New York, with branches in Boston, Philadelphia, Detroit, and other cities. The Supreme Court sat in Chicago, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were based in Atlanta, and other government departments were spread throughout the Midwest and along the Eastern Seaboard in various urban centers. This strange decentralization was partially a function of post-war paranoia and partially an effort to maintain control in civilized areas. Florida had become a modern-day version of the Dry Tortugas, a semi-independent state with its corrupt capital in Miami, a haven for pirates from the Gulf and the Caribbean, as well as every other criminal, hustler, and freebooter from Savannah to the Florida Keys. Most of the Southwest, with the exception of cities such as Phoenix, Santa Fe, and Albuquerque, had regressed to the frontier lifestyle of the 1800s. The Northwest and the Mountain States had been the hardest hit. There were still hotspots in Idaho, Montana, Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming, as well as the Dakotas. Isolated pockets of civilization existed in Washington State and Oregon, but California had been devastated. The strikes out there had triggered off the big one, and the Golden State had a radically different coastline. New York City had collapsed into itself like a dying star. Midtown Manhattan had escaped destruction, but the southernmost tip of Manhattan, once the home of the financial district, was now a rubble of twisted steel, shattered glass, and crumbled concrete. Out in New York Harbor, the Statue of Liberty had been reduced to molten slag, and hardly anything remained of Staten Island. The Bronx was like a DMZ, largely deserted, and much of Long Island was a ghost town, with the surviving settlements under the control of several large, heavily fortified and well-organized criminal enclaves. Miniature mob kingdoms ruled Queens, Brooklyn, and Long Beach. The government had managed to topple one of them, the powerful Borodini enclave on the north shore of Cold Spring Harbor. But the others still operated like independent city-states, drawing on the freebooters plying the Atlantic coast for their supplies, as well as the agro-communes and the fishing fleets operated by the Brood, a large gang of outlaw bikers who had seized control of the far eastern end of the island. On Manhattan Island, everything south of Houston Street and East 2nd Avenue up to 34th Street, as well as the entire strip along the Hudson River from Battery Park to the collapsed Lincoln Tunnel, was a lawless no-man's land populated by derelicts, outlaws, and paramilitary street gangs that controlled the shaky economy of the slums and ruled its poverty-stricken residents. Everything north of 110th Street was a decimated ghetto, primarily under the control of a powerful black street gang called the Skulls, what had once been the greatest city in the world now had its mass densely clustered at the center, a core city surrounded by a twilight zone of urban jungle. It was the same throughout much of the country. Initially, the survivors had fled the cities in droves, but they had found the rural areas well defended by farmers, ranchers, and small town citizens for whom guns and hunting had been a way of life. Many of them were outdoorsmen and gun collectors. Others were survivalists whose worst nightmares had come true. They were well prepared to defend their homes from the hordes of hungry, frightened, desperate people who had fled the cities. And those who had spent their lives in pampered urban comfort soon found that they were very ill-equipped to survive outside the environs of the cities. Before long, the survivors started drifting back to once more make their homes in cities that had suddenly had no shortage of accommodations, where they could depend, at least to some degree, upon the overworked authorities who struggled to restore some semblance of law and order as they tried to revitalize a crippled economy and feed their starving citizens. Slowly, society stumbled back to its feet, but it was still staggering and weaving like a battered prizefighter in the final round. The police forces patrolled the crime-ridden streets, like British commandos once patrolled the streets of Ulster, dressed for combat and armed with automatic weapons. The military had their hands full trying to restore order to the outlying areas and protecting the farm settlements that had been reorganized as agro-communes, supplying the hungry cities by means of well-armed military convoys. The social order had become surreal. In the core cities, people lived and worked and voted and paid taxes, but there were few who didn't own and carry guns. And despite the stressful temper of the times, there were nowhere near as many shootings as might have been expected. An armed society was a polite society. And then politeness was enforced not only by police, but by a growth industry in personal security, numerous private concerns regulated by the police, contracted with building and block associations, as well as businesses to provide armed guards for the protection of the premises. Yet, on the fringes of the cities, in the slums, in what were once the wealthy suburbs, what little order and economy existed was administered by outlaw gangs that often competed with each other for control. The police patrolled the borders of the cities and sought to gradually extend them block by block and street by street. But all too often, they would bring one small piece of no man's land under control, only to have another area ignite. And once they dealt with that, they found the gangs back in control of the area that they had just subdued. As for the remainder of the country, the rural areas, the small towns and the villages, were largely on their own. here and there in more populated regions. National Guard units, augmented by local police and citizenry, protected the towns from bands of savage raiders that roamed the devastated countryside. Elsewhere, vigilante justice was the law. Some local governments, such as they were, maintained contact with federal authorities. Others pointedly avoided it, distrusting the government that they blamed for bringing them to such a state. Texas was the prime example. They had been spared the missile strikes, but not the ravages of the plague, and with only the shallow Rio Grande separating them from Mexico, they felt that they had enough problems of their own without having to deal and concern themselves with those of the rest of the country. Their solution had been elegantly simple. They formed their own republic with a new capital in Dallas, and they closed all their borders except the one on the Mexico side. As a result, they had a steady influx of cheap labor to maintain their own economy, and their influence extended well beyond the Rio Grande. They traded with the freebooters in the Gulf and eliminated problems with narcotics by legalizing drugs. They maintained diplomatic relations with the federal government, but they had no desire to subject themselves to its authority. They were doing better on their own. And legislators like Senator Bryce Carman were painfully aware that Texas stood as a dangerous example to the other states. The tax base, such as it was pathetically inadequate to the task of getting the country back on its feet once more. Military units would often without months without receiving any pay, and there were frequent problems with keeping the troops under control. Carman and the other members of the subcommittee had become, out of necessity, legislative hatchet men, with a crippled government forced to operate on a shoestring budget. They had to cut wherever possible, and Higgins knew that one of the areas Carman wanted to cut most was the already pared-down budget of the CIA. The agency was, in Carman's view, a dinosaur that had outlived its time. Royce Harding, the agency director, had already seen the writing on the wall. He had submitted meekly to the knife each time he was brought before Carman's committee. He hadn't even bothered to insist upon attending when Higgins was summoned to appear before them. He was already thinking of the next post that Carman could help him to secure if he played ball. Higgins alone, as the director of the agency's Project Download and its subsidiary, Project Steel, was the sole remaining reason for a budgetary allocation. He had managed to keep it afloat only because the project had proved so successful. They had demonstrated that it was possible for people to use biochips implanted in their brains to interface directly with computers. It allowed them to download vital knowledge and abilities that could then be programmed into others, thereby saving untold effort and expense in training important personnel. A direct outgrowth of that process had been Project Steel, a man with sophisticated Nysteel alloy prosthetics, incorporating weapon systems in a cybernetic brain programmed with human mental engrams. Lieutenant Donovan Steele was a cyborg, a prototype of the weapon of the future, capable of doing the work of over a dozen highly trained military or police personnel. Steele's performance had been so outstanding that even Carman was impressed and had voted to continue with the funding, enabling them to proceed with Project Stalker, a second-generation cyborg. But now, the project had been dealt a staggering setback, perhaps even a mortal blow. Stalker went insane as soon as he was brought online. He had murdered his creators and gone on a killing spree throughout the city before Steele finally destroyed him. Now, as Higgins sat and waited while Carman and his fellow subcommittee members consulted the reports before them, he knew that in a matter of moments, he would be fighting for his life. "I'm sure we don't need to tell you why you're here, Mr. Higgins," Carman began, still looking down and leafing through the report. "The last time you appeared before this subcommittee, you assured us that your project was an unqualified success and that you had ironed out any and all potential difficulties inherent in the process of producing cyborgs." He paused and fixed Higgins with an unwavering stare. "Isn't that correct?" Higgins cleared his throat. "Yes, sir, I did say that. However, Carmen interrupted. "As it turns out, there were still some rather significant difficulties that had not been, as you put it, ironed out. Difficulties that were graphically demonstrated in Project Stalker, your second-generation cyborg. And using the term difficulties in this case is rather an understatement. Wouldn't you agree?" Higgins did not respond. "Nothing to say, Mr. Higgins?" Carman said, raising his bushy white eyebrows. I'm sorry, sir. I had assumed it was a rhetorical question, Higgins said. However, I would tend to agree with that the word difficulties might be an understatement, considering the way you put it. Oh, how would you put it, Mr. Higgins? I'd say it was largely a matter of perspective, sir. Perspective? Really? Would you care to explain that? Yes, sir, I would. Looking at it from the standpoint of what resulted, which is to say, considering what happened from the perspective of purely subjective human terms, I'd say that the word tragedy would be much more appropriate. However, when you examine the situation from a strictly scientific perspective, the word difficulties would not by any means be an understatement. Under the circumstances, Mr. Higgins, Carmen said dryly, I find you are taking refuge in semantics in this matter, in poor taste, and wholly inappropriate. With all due respect, sir, it's not a matter of semantics, and I'd appreciate the opportunity to clarify that statement. By all means, please do, said Carmen with a wry grimace. This committee has already been misled enough. We would greatly appreciate clarification in this manner. Yes, sir. To begin, I'd like to state for the record that there was never any attempt on my part or on the part of any of the project staff to mislead this committee. My original report to this committee was and is correct. We have successfully eliminated all the technological problems inherent in the process of producing cyborgs. The process works. The prosthetics and the cybernetic systems involved in both Project Steel and Project Stalker functioned flawlessly throughout. In both cases, the process of downloading mental engrams from the human brain and the subsequent loading of these engrams into a cybernetic brain worked perfectly. Technically, there were no problems. However, we're not dealing with a strictly technical situation here. We're also dealing with the human factor. In both cases, Higgins continued, the subjects had experienced brain damage prior to being cyborged. As a result, in each case, it was necessary to supplement the engram matrix with ancillary data obtained during prior downloading test runs with other subjects. The details are covered in the report. This supplementary data was incorporated into the engram matrix to make up for the damage resulting from the subject's injuries. In the case of Project Steel, it did not in any way interfere with the subject's ability to function, as you have observed yourselves. In the case of Project Stalker, the brain damage was apparently much more severe. It's also possible that the subject had some prior existing psychological problems inherent in his personality.
Just a moment, Mr. Higgins, said Roberta Dillingsworth, the senator from Pennsylvania. Let me get this straight. Are you trying to claim that your second cyborg went out of control because he was insane to begin with?
No, ma'am, not exactly. That would be an oversimplification, Higgins replied.
It sounds more like obfuscation to me, said Dillingsworth with a frown. We have complete files on both men, including their psychological profiles, and in neither case are any psychological problems indicated.
Yes, ma'am, that is quite true, said Higgins. However, both subjects were veteran NYPD Strike Force officers, and in that capacity, they were subject to regular and frequent psychiatric evaluations. As police psychiatrists will readily attest, officers tend to resent these periodic evaluations. They come to believe, not without some justification, that the department shrinks are looking for the least excuse to remove them from active strike force duty. They become cautious and defensive. The longer they remain on the force, the more adept they become at playing what they call the game, concealing their true feelings and trying to outwit their examiners. An officer with emotional problems would never seek help from a police psychiatrist for fear of being removed from duty. There are, unfortunately, many documented cases where such problems were never revealed until they resulted in a tragic breakdown, a psychosis, or a suicide. These men often build up walls and hide their innermost feelings, even from their wives. In other words, the fact that their psychological profiles didn't indicate any problems doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't there. The fact remains that we followed the same basic procedure for both cyborgs. The first one experienced no problems and remains perfectly functional in all respects. The second one went insane and had to be destroyed. And that task was accomplished by Lieutenant Steele, which should clearly demonstrate his capacities. My point, he concluded, is that the fault does not lie with the process, which works and works extremely well. The only variable factor we're looking at here is that of human personality. To put it another way, if one soldier has a breakdown and becomes psychotic, you don't disband the entire army, do you? Dillingsworth pursed her lips thoughtfully and nodded. And looking to the other members of the committee, Higgins could see he'd made his point, even if he had stretched the truth a little. Carmen frowned. "I'd also like to reiterate," said Higgins quickly, striking while the iron was still hot, "that the production of cyborgs is only a byproduct of what Project Download is really all about. An important byproduct, but a byproduct nonetheless. We're suffering from a drastic shortage of trained personnel. Given enough funding, we'll be able to utilize the process to remedy that situation. And it isn't a question of if we can do it. It's a question of when. And all of our preliminary experiments have resulted in dramatic successes. Right now, we can take a download from a highly trained soldier, implant it with a biochip, and create a program that will allow us to produce as many soldiers of equal capabilities as we can manufacture biochips for. And we can do it in a fraction of the time that it would take to train them normally. We can do the same thing with police officers, technicians, teachers, scientists, any needed occupation. Even politicians," said Carmen with a smile. Higgins didn't fall into the trap. Well, some abilities are more subtle and refined than others," he said offhandedly so it wouldn't sound like he was stroking them. "Leadership, for example, is more a function of, you know, the personality than learned abilities. The chief aim of the project is to enhance human learning ability by means of computer technology. Obviously, it would be much more difficult to pass on leadership potential than, say, combat skills or technical knowledge. Chances are it might not even be possible. However, that's not what we're concerned with. We can't alter human personality," he said, knowing full well that they could do precisely that. "But we can pass on human skills and knowledge. And that alone can revolutionize society and help us pull this country back together. I realize that you're under extremely tight budgetary constraints, but continued funding of the project will enable you to save a tremendous amount of money in the long run. Additionally, Cyborg can free up a lot of personnel for more necessary tasks. Our work is vital and imperative. Cutting our funding at this stage would be like killing off the goose that lays the golden eggs. I won't quibble with the fact that you lay eggs," said Carmen dryly, "but I'm not convinced that they are made of gold. In fact, some of them seem downright poisonous. Project Stalker was a particular case in point. A lot of lives were lost as a result. The people are holding us accountable. They want assurances that such a thing will not occur again, and it's our responsibility to give them those assurances. Frankly, Mr. Higgins, you haven't said anything that leads me to believe that you can guarantee that it won't happen again. Sir, I haven't finished," Carmen said. "I'm inclined to agree with you that Project Download is addressing a real, very present need. However, I don't believe that cyborgs are a part of it. Using computer technology to improve human learning ability is one thing. Using that same technology to create people, that pop machine, is something else entirely. It's extremely controversial, incredibly expensive, and what's more, as we have already seen, it can be highly dangerous. And I think this world is already dangerous enough. We have to deliberate on this, but I think it's going to be my recommendation to the subcommittee that no further funding be allocated for this procedure or production of any more cyborgs. I think the main thrust of Project Download is too important to channel valuable financial resources to any questionable byproducts. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that the CIA is the proper agency to administer this project. Your handling of it has certainly left much to be desired. However, we'll take that up during our next session. Right now, unless any of our honored members have any further questions, I think that we can adjourn for lunch. He glanced around the dais, but no one had anything else to add. Very well, then. On behalf of my fellow members, Mr. Higgins, I'd like to thank you for appearing before this congressional subcommittee and express my appreciation and commend you for your cooperation. You've been extremely helpful, and I can assure you that your views will be given due consideration. This meeting is adjourned until 2 o'clock this afternoon. The gavel lifted, and the hammer fell. Dr. Jennifer Stone was waiting for him in the hall outside the meeting room. She was a stunningly attractive woman in her mid-30s with shoulder-length red hair and bright green eyes. Hers was the kind of vivacious beauty that expressed itself no matter how she tried to tone it down. But any man who tried to take her at face value soon found out that he had bitten off a lot more than he could chew. Jennifer Stone had learned a lot at a very early age that beauty such as hers could be as much of a liability as an asset. In fact, it could only be an asset if she chose to exploit it, as many attractive women did. But that was not her way. She was too intelligent to downplay her abilities and too proud to be manipulative. Instead, she was aggressive, highly capable, and professional to a fault. And until she had met Higgins, she had never been involved with any men. Men, she had found, were too time-consuming. Those who were not intimidated by her strength and her intelligence had a tendency to ask much more of her than she was willing to give. She was married to her career, and she had no time for any lovers. So she had held them at bay with her brisk, professional demeanor and her brook-no-nonsense personality until she had met Oliver Higgins. And then something very strange had happened. Higgins had given her the opportunity of a lifetime. After the tragic murder of Dr. Philip Gates, the brilliant cybernetics engineer who had headed up the team responsible for Steel and Stalker, Higgins had selected her on the basis of her professional record to come out from Los Alamos, where she was associated with a branch for the Project Download, and take over the lab at the project headquarters in the Federal Building. She had leaped at the chance to work with Donovan Steele, the first man in history to receive an artificial brain. What she had found when she arrived was something even more fascinating. For the first few days after her arrival, she had thrown herself into the task of supervising the rebuilding of the lab that Stalker had destroyed and trying to recover all of the damaged data. She had lived out of her office on the 22nd floor, sleeping on the couch and showering in the basement gym, putting in 18-hour days and driving her staff almost as hard as she drove herself. Higgins had been very much impressed, and she, in turn, had been very much impressed with him. He was a handsome man in his 40s, suave and urbane, not at all the sort of dull and officious bureaucrat she had expected. And though he was a layman, the CIA administrator in charge of the project, he had a quick mind and a crisp, professional demeanor that appealed to her. He never once spoke to her condescendingly or made a pass, but from the very first had treated her as a colleague, not in the least bit threatened by her intelligence. She was not initially attracted to him, or at least she didn't think she was, but she had summed him up quickly with a curt mental nod of approval, thinking, "Good. The man's a pro. I can work with him." And then everything went kerblooey. He had invited her up into his office one night after she had finished up her day's work at the lab and asked her professional opinion concerning a problem that he wasn't quite sure what to do with. When she had seen what it was, she felt as if she had been gut-punched. The late Dr. Philip Gates, ever the methodical engineer, had kept a backup copy of Steele's downloaded mental engram matrix in computer storage. Dr. Devin Cooper, the project psychiatrist, whom she had known back at Los Alamos, had pulled a second backup copy of the matrix in order to spend more time analyzing Steele at home. He had felt strongly that Steele, who had a cop's distrust of shrinks, was keeping something back from him. Something that was disturbing him profoundly. Gates had given him a VS peripheral that enabled Dev Cooper to speak with the Matrix,
and the voice synthesizer that had been programmed to respond with Steele's own voice, with assistance of Dr. Julie Nakamura, who had also been killed when Stalker ran amok, Cooper had programmed an imperative into the Matrix, roughly an electronic equivalent of truth serum, that was meant to ensure that the Matrix would respond truthfully to any questions Cooper put to it. It was that last part that had fascinated Jennifer. An engram matrix was essentially nothing more than software. And software could not choose to respond or to respond untruthfully. A computer program did not have free will. It gave the user any data that was requested, provided, of course, that the data was contained within its files. But the engram matrix was a backed up download of Steele's personality, augmented with ancillary data. It had free will. It was alive. Supposedly, it was nothing more than data, software that could not function unless it was loaded into a sophisticated cybernetic brain and brought online. But they had discovered that the engram matrix was capable of functioning in almost any computer, making that computer come to life. It was far more than merely software. It was a person without a body. It was human. It was self-aware. And it was an exact duplicate of Steele's personality, an electronic clone. That discovery had brought Dev Cooper to the edge of a mental breakdown. He had become drug and alcohol dependent. He couldn't sleep unless he drank himself into unconsciousness, and he needed to take stimulants to stay awake. Higgins had bugged his apartment and discovered what he had done. While Cooper was away, Higgins had sent agents to his apartment with orders to boot up the Matrix so that he could take a download through the phone line, creating yet another backup copy so that he could see what Cooper had been up to. He believed that Cooper had modified the program in some way, and he had asked Jennifer's expert opinion. When she made the same discovery that Cooper made, the implications of it had rocked her. Adrenaline trip-hammered through her body as she realized that she had stumbled upon the scientific discovery of the century. And the thrill of the discovery, the staggering significance of it, the stress, the pressure, and all those years of self-denial had opened up the floodgates. It was all released in a torrent of long repressed sexual energy, and she had practically attacked Higgins, making love with him right there on his office desk. But in their excitement, they hadn't realized that someone else was watching. The Matrix, still booted up in the computer, and it had switched on the surveillance camera in the office to tape them making love. What followed had unnerved them both completely. The copy of the Matrix, still in Cooper's possession, had contacted their copy of the Matrix through the phone lines, and the two had integrated. And then the Matrix had utilized the power lines to escape from the computer. It had raided the databanks in the Maximum Security Project Lab, and there had been nothing they could do to stop it. And now they had no idea where it was. Higgins had not dared to give that information to the subcommittee. Carmen would have crucified him. Only three people have knowledge of it. Higgins, Stone, and Cooper, who was confined to his apartment under house arrest. There were two agents with him at all times to make sure that Cooper took no drugs and used no drink. Cooper knew too much for Higgins to risk him having him dry out in the hospital. They were doing it the hard way because they needed him. But unknown to either of them, there was one other person who Cooper had let in on the secret. Father Liam Casey, the Catholic priest who was Steele's close friend and confessor. And though Cooper wasn't Catholic, he had unburdened his soul to Father Casey in good faith and trust. And it was a trust that the worried priest could not betray. Not even Steele knew that he had an electronic clone. Somewhere. Jennifer Stone took one look at Higgins, at the expression on Higgins' face, and didn't need to ask him how it went. It was only a question of hearing the damage report. "How bad was it?" she asked. "Bad," said Higgins grimly. "Give me a few minutes, okay? I'm so mad right now. I could shoot that son of a bitch Carmen in the head. I need a drink." He stuck an unlit pipe into his mouth as they headed toward the elevators. A second later, Jennifer heard a sharp snap. He had bitten through the stem. They took the elevator up to the third floor and walked down the long, spacious, carpeted hallway to the Congressional Lounge that had one time been the UN Delegates Bar. The long bar was at the far end of the large, airy lounge. To the right, just past the huge tapestry of the Great Wall of China, that was about the size of a tennis court, a relic from the days of the UN. To their left, the entire wall was glass, affording a view of the Rose Garden and the East River, with the ruins of the 59th Street Bridge in the background. Low, circular wood tables with luxurious lounge chairs, upholstered in black leather, were placed around the room. They sat down, and Higgins gave the waiter an order for two scotches, straight up, doubles. He took the pipe out of his mouth and only then noticed that he had bitten through the stem. He grimaced and put it back in his pocket. Jennifer said nothing. Though she had known him only for a short time, they'd become extremely close. They were more than lovers. They were friends and colleagues. And she had never seen him like this before. Except when they made love. Higgins rarely revealed his emotions. Now the muscles in his neck were corded, his jaw was clenched, and his eyes were hard as anthracite. For a long time, he merely stared at the window, without speaking. She gave him time. The drinks arrived. He tossed his back in two quick swallows and immediately ordered another. Some legislators and bureaucrats started to drift in to drink their lunch. A few had sat on the committee. They pointedly avoided him. Senator Carman was not among them. Bryce Carman did not drink. Bryce Carman did not smoke. As far as he knew, and being CIA, Higgins knew a lot, Bryce Carman didn't even screw. The man seemed to have no vices whatsoever, unless one counted power. And Carman hoarded power like Midas hoarded gold. Higgins wished to God that he had something on the man, anything. But Carman seemed to live up to his nickname, the White Knight. He was pure, and he was a crusader, and he had just reached out with his lance and spiked Higgins to the earth. "We're dead," said Higgins finally. Jennifer merely listened. "I tried," he continued. "I gave it my best shot, and I really thought I had it working. But that bastard Carman pulled the rug right out from under me. On behalf of the subcommittee, I'd like to thank you and commend you for your cooperation. Your views will be given due consideration." "Sanctimonious cocksucker." Jennifer raised her eyebrow. The language did not offend her, it merely surprised her, coming from Higgins. It could only mean one thing. The worst had happened. "They cut the funding?" she said with a sinking feeling. She had already known it, but somehow she had hoped that she was wrong. "Yeah," said Higgins. "Oh, they're going to deliberate, and it looks like as if they'll continue to fund the downloading research, but we built our last cyborg." "What about steel?" she said. Higgins shook his head. "I don't know. They didn't say. I guess we'll have to hope that these new upgrades hold up, because there probably won't be any more. If he breaks now, he'll probably stay broke." "Surely they won't just abandon him," she said. "Not for all he's been through." "You want to bet?" Higgins smiled wryly. "You know the funny thing about it, though? Steele would probably much rather have it that way. The only thing he hates more than psychiatrists is bureaucrats. He'll go back to the strike force once again and be happy as a pig in mud."
"So are we all out of a job?" she asked.
"Not you," said Higgins. "You'll probably be transferred back to Los Alamos. But me, I'm history. Stalker gave Carman the perfect excuse to shut me down. The CIA makes killer cyborgs. So they're scuttling the cyborg project and taking download away from the agency. Without download, there's no longer any real reason for this agency to continue to exist. Harding's spineless. He's been sitting on his hands and letting them whittle us away for years. Without download, we're no longer doing anything the military can't handle. I guess I should start looking for a job."
"You ever thinking of moving out to Los Alamos?" she asked.
He raised his eyebrows and then smiled. "You offering to set me up in my own apartment, doctor? What kind of man do you think I am?"
"The different kind," she said. "The kind who'd probably wouldn't rattle my chain too much. The kind who probably wouldn't drive any other woman crazy because you don't need a woman. But then, I don't really need a man, so we're a perfect match."
"Matches start fires."
"Yeah, but we both like the heat."
He smiled. "There is that. Only we're both workaholics. You'd be okay, but what the hell would an ex-spook like me do in New Mexico? I'm a little old for punching crows."
"Oh, there's lots of things out there for you to punch," she said. "Remember all the times you told me about your younger days before you got promoted to a desk? Your eyes always lit up when you spoke about your days out in the field with that special unit. What was it called?
The Special Operations Group.
That's right. Troubleshooters. Hot shots. There's room for hot shots out there, Oliver. It's not like Midtown. The No Man's Land out there is really something. It's big. It's wild. You could be young again. There'd be lots out there for a man like you to do. I'm progressive. I don't really mind you having a career, so long as you got your pants down around your ankles when I get home.
I see. You're only interested in me for the sex.
Isn't that what men are for?
Listen to you. 35 years you stayed a virgin, and now all of a sudden you're a sex maniac.
I've got a lot of catching up to do. Only, I want to do it on my terms, with a man who'll accept me as I am without getting in my hair. Look, we both need a lot of space, and we respect that in each other. Neither one of us wants children. We're both aggressive, we're both compulsive, type A personalities. We feed off one another's energy, and we're great in the bed together. So how about it?
Is that a marriage proposal, doctor?
Marriage, she said. Who the hell said anything about marriage? I'm only asking you to shack up with me.
Oh, why buy the cow when you can have the milk for free? Is that it?
Yeah, cows give manure too, and it's getting a little deep around here.
Fuck you!
Okay, let's go back to my place. I picked up the new black leather outfit I've been dying to try out.
He grinned. You're crazy, you know that?
No, just horny.
She said.
What do you say? Let's get drunk and fuck our brains out.
Have you really got a black leather outfit?
With matching boots, she said.
Ooh.
No, I'll tell you when to say ooh. The girl in the store told me an interesting game you can play with four sets of handcuffs, a feather, and some ice cubes.
Ice cubes?
It has to do with timing,
she said with a sly smile. Higgins cleared his throat. Matching boots, huh?
With 6-inch heels.
Higgins signaled the waiter. Check, please! End of chapter.